Good morning and welcome to the International Connection. We are in show number 33 on our series on mind control, and today we are going to hear a presentation, The Secret History of Mind Control, given by Walter Boert at the Ritual Trauma, Child Abuse, and Mind Control Conference in Atlanta in October of this year. Walter Boert is an investigative journalist and author of one of the original books about mind control in the late 70s entitled Operation Mind Control. And now, Walter Boert.
I guess Walter almost needs no introduction because he was really probably the first person to publicly write about mind control and its origins and so forth. His book, Operation Mind Control, is available and his table in the back, and I think it's available as a membership, right?
I've got a plug built in.
Yeah, good. Great. He's prepared. Anyway, most recently, Walter was involved as a consultant in the making of the movie Conspiracy Theory, and some of you may have seen him actually interviewed for an HBO special promoting the movie. It's the first time I ever got to see what Walter looked like, so I would recognize him when he came. Anyway, he has a Freedom of Thought Foundation, which he will tell you about, and he's going to share his information with you. So welcome, Walter.
Thank you. I'd like to thank some people. I was going to save it to the end, but I want to get it right up front since a couple of them are here. I'd like to thank Mike Coyle for what he contributed to this. What you're going to see is an outtake, a series of outtakes, and some of them are from videos, and a lot of them are stills, but it's a very rough presentation of what's going to be a documentary. But I'd like to thank Mike Coyle, who's retired from the field. He had the MindNet journal that was on the internet and did a terrific job of research. And he's finding that a lot of the critical things that we're going to talk about and get to toward the end of the show are actually removed from journals and pages torn out of research, academic research journals and things. Somebody doesn't want this information out. And I'm going to cover things. I'm going back. Sylvia asked me to do the history of mind control, but I'm going to cover that. But I'm going to go farther afield, probably than what most of you have heard about. And it is so far beyond any technology that you're talking about, like electromagnetic spectrum stuff. We're into post-quantum physics here, and now we're working with physicists. I'd like to also thank Blanche Chavesty, who's here, for the long years of friendship and the documentation that she is and research that she's helped us with, and Cheryl Welch, who I think is not here, who also contributed boxes and boxes of research, and Doreen Pratt, who is hospitalized and not able to travel and is blind, legally blind, and you'll see some of her work in this presentation. And I'd like to thank all the members of the Freedom of Thought Foundation for their assistance and friendship and guidance over the 20 years that we've been doing this. So it's the title is The Secret of Secret History of Mind Control, which you've looked at that slide long enough, and see if this works. The big key to the thing is that only the small secrets need to be kept. You can find out just about anything the government's doing by going to scientific journals and research, but the big secrets are kept by public incredulity. And your study and your experience is in an area which is not secret. All this has been known for a long time, but people don't want to believe it. And there's like a great deal of denial in this thing. So with the evolution of that is hard to see. With the evolution of man came the evolution of science, and here's an example of an early treatment by the foremost practitioners of mental health science, in quotes. This is an etching circa 1745. It shows a ward in, actually it's spelled Bethlehem Hospital in London. It was pronounced Bethlehem, and it became Bedlam, the famous synonym for the nut house. But it was originally, it was Bethlehem Hospital. And another patient at Bethlehem, his name was William Norris, and he was confined there for 12 years, bound by chains a foot long into an iron rod at the head of his bed. He died in 1815. Another patient there at Bethlehem, who we do not have a picture of, was James Tilly Matthews. This is another, we don't know who that is, but he was Matthews. Let's pretend it's Matthews. He was incarcerated there for 35 years and escaped only by death. And it's a very interesting story. In the late 1700s, he'd gone to France as a spy for the British Admiralty, posing as an import-export agent. He traveled in the highest circles of French society. Things went wrong for him when he fell into the hands of a man named Franz Anton Mesmer, the father of hypnotism. Mesmer used to play parlor games by having aristocrats stand in tubs of water while he played DC current over their heads. To what purpose? We don't know. And this may be the first perpetrator of mind control, one of the fathers of our country, Benjamin Franklin. He was the U.S. ambassador to France at the time. And if you remember, he was the discoverer of electricity, which was DC electricity. He discovered it when he flew a kite on a wire during an electrical storm. And it was a shocking experience. Franklin may have been used that later for the effects that DC current, we now know DC current gives. It'll induce amnesia easily. Franklin was asked by the French government to look into the activities of Mesmer and his claims of miraculous cures with electricity. And they hit it off. Mesmer and Franklin hit it off real well, but it's not surprising. They were both the brothers of the same secret society, the Masons. And so Franklin filed a lengthy report favorable to Mesmer, gave it to the French government. Another brother Mason who frequently visited them in Paris was Adam Weishaupt, the founder of the Illuminati. And these coincidences bring a lot of questions to your mind about what were these guys really doing over there, and what did they find out. Mesmer happened to be believe it or not, the godfather of Amadeus Mozart. In fact, he raised Mozart. And, of course, Mozart was this incredible genius musician. And his biography, the biographies of Mozart, show you more than one obvious example of someone who behaves as if he were suffering from dissociative identity disorder. So, you know, you can conclude that maybe Mesmer played around to enhance the musical abilities of Mozart at the cost of other parts of his personality. Well, you can't read these things, but anyway, we're back to James Tilly Matthews, and after a few years of influence of Franklin and Mesmer, he was over there in France, he beat a path as soon as he could back to England, reported to the Admiralty that French had developed a devastating instrument of war, an heirloom, A-I-R-L-O-M, which could weave thoughts into a man's mind. These are some of the at the top it says Illustrations of Madness. That's the name of the book written by John Haslam. John Haslam was the apothecary, which in modern terms would be the resident medical officer, to Bethlehem Hospital toward the end of Matthew's stay in the first decade of the 19th century. Haslam wrote this whole volume called Illustrations of Madness. On just singly on the Matthews case. It was published in 1810. It was the first book-length case study of a single patient in British psychiatric history. According to Roy Porter, who repackaged Haslam's 1810 book, Illustrations of Madness, in 1988, and that's the only way you're going to find it. There are rare volumes. You've got to pay probably at least $40 for a used copy. Because of the book, Matthew's fate became a cause célèbre in everywhere, in Britain and the United States, and it was used against Bethlehem Hospital in general and Haslam in particular, ironically. When the institution came under scathing scrutiny of the House of Commons Committee investigating madhouses in 1815, a few years before the madhouse era, there were only a few people declared insane, but by the late 1700s and early 1800s, there were hundreds of thousands of people now in these madhouses, so-called. So while this guy was Matthews was is interesting to us for other reasons, he was the cause célèbre that created social reform in the madhouse business. According to Porter, the significance of his case was way back about 200 years ago. He was describing experiences that modern victims of mind control are now describing, even using some of the same terms. I don't know if you can see some of them up there, but I'll go over them in a minute. Today, Matthews would be diagnosed as having delusional disorder. And I think delusional disorder is a misdiagnosis for a whole lot of things, but that he certainly fits the bill for delusional disorder. And maybe he'd be diagnosed as suffering from schizophrenia or paranoid schizophrenia, which we now know is an extremely rare disease. But when I read Operation Mind Control back 78, there were only 25 MPD cases diagnosed. Now there's hundreds of thousands. And most of the people that I was writing about were called schizophrenic by the doctors. And they weren't. Of course, they were DID. But a guy named Dr. George Birkbeck of London examined the Haslam in those days and testified before the King's Bench that after paying James Tilley Matthews 6 visits at Bethlehem and having attempted, quote, by every mode of examination which he could devise to, quote, discover the real state of his mind, he said that Matthews was not insane. He said basically he's not insane after all this research on the guy. But he's talking about sudden death, squeezing, lobster cracking, you know. And anyway, he was admitted on the 28th of January 1797 to Bethlehem after he had been behaving oddly for quite a while, about a year. And among his strange behavior was writing a letter to his benefactor, Lord Liverpool, saying, who was in the Admiralty and was part of this intelligence scam that he was involved in, I pronounce your lordship to be in every sense of the word a most diabolical traitor. After a long life of political and real iniquity, during which your lordship, by flattering and deceiving and more than anyone contributing to deceive your king, who, believing your hypocritical professions, has to be detriment of many of the country's friends, loaded you with honors and emollients, you have made yourself a principal in schemes of treason founded upon the most extensive intrigue, and which have not only long since laid your country at the feet of its most bitter enemies who have assassinated France to reap further advantages from those who by such wickedness might in such general assassinating scamble mount the throne, and so forth, written in the grand prose of that day. And that'll get you locked up, you know. Even today, that gets you locked up. But he's talking about thought-making, you know. Haslam, the doctor that treated him in those days, said, in this situation, he continued for many years, sometimes an automaton, moved by the agency of persons hereafter to be introduced to the notice of the reader. And of course, he talked about spies and thugs and assassins who were putting voices in his head and controlling him. So Mr. M insists that in some apartment near London Wall, there is a gang of villains profoundly skilled in pneumatic, as in air pump, pneumatic chemistry, who assail him by means of an air loom, A-I-R-L-O-O-M. Continuing, of a variety of tortures he described so colorfully were fluid locking, cutting soul from sense, stone making, thigh talking, kiting involving magnetic impregnations, he said, sudden death squeezing, lobster cracking caused by pressure from the, quote, magnetic atmosphere surrounding the person assailed, unquote, apoplexy working with the nutmeg grater, lengthening the brain, thought making while one of these villains is sucking at the brain of the person assailed to extract his existing sentiments, another of the gang will force into his mind a train of ideas very different from the real subject of his thoughts and which is squeezed upon as the desired information by the person sucking, unquote. Laughter making, poking, pushing up the quicksilver, bladder filling, tying down, bomb bursting, gas plucking, that's the extraction of magnetic fluid from a person assailed, unquote. Foot curving, lethargy making, spark exploding, knee nailing, burning out, eye screwing, sight stopping, roof stringing, vital tearing, fiber ripping, brain sayings, and other descriptions of physical and psychological tortures caused by some invisible means, which Matthews put into the high-tech terms of his day. Now, this is very similar to what people are describing today. This is the way he drew a layout of the way he was assailed and interrogated in his by these 17th century assassins, he called them. And he said that a pneumatic machine, and this is a sketch he made of it, was used with the high technology that was doing all this. So try to find, if you're interested in this, try to find the book. You have to do a search for it. And but the EM targeted victims of today are not sounding much different than that. Though this guy is pretty colorful, and of course the language is very arcane and colorful. But Matthews, we'll go back to Matthews, he was the first, it was like 200 years ago, you know? And he was the first guy that's chronicled, and he's the first single individual case ever chronicled in psychiatric literature that we know of. So it's not, this is nothing new. Now, could it be those guys, Franklin and those other guys, came up with something that they really did use? Because that's what he claimed. Today we have the categories of, I don't like the term, but it's used, wavies. Those are people that are targets of electromagnetic waves of some kind, or sometimes I prefer the term EM-targeted victims, or some of these people claim to be alien abductees, or government mind-control victim, or satanic abused people. Now, there's nothing in Matthew's descriptions that these groups of people haven't also described experiencing. So, and then you have to ask, doing what I did for 20 years, you're hearing all these stories, you're gathering probably the largest database, and we're beginning to use a 27-page questionnaire, you know, people with ordinary, I'm looking for mind control victims, and of course our questionnaire is a mind control questionnaire, but it kind of gives you an indication of what everything else is in there, and including the alien abduction scenario, which is very peculiar and very unusual. And but we have the largest probably database, and after you hear this, you say, could it be that these delusions, if they are delusions, do we as a species lack such imagination as to keep coming up with the same thing over and over for 200 years? I mean, can't we go beyond this? You know, shouldn't madness be really out there and really, but something's happening here. There's a pattern to this. And you hear people who don't know each other, who have no contact with this thing at all, who've never read a book on it, saying the same thing. And they can sit down with some people, some survivors that have experienced trauma abuse and trauma-based programming, and compare notes, and it'll be the same. And it runs true. So this is later. This is already now in the early 19th century. We've got the Lavery Electric Phrenometer. It was a high-tech of its day. It was intended to accurately measure the bumps on your head and so predict the nature, type, and behavior of individuals who'd hold still for it. You know? And it was taken very seriously for a while until somebody said, hey, there's no database for this, you know. And this guy, again, early 20th century, Mental Poisoning. It was a popular book written by a psychologist in the early days when people were hearing voices. Mental Poisoning, he talked about. And then we got more scientific, you know. That's the obsolete version of Colin Ross's book. And he made a contribution to the field by doing that research. And here we go in the 1920s or 30s. Everybody was hearing voices. Everybody. And all you had to do was turn on the radio. And there was no need for implanted electrodes to control your behavior. Here's a Nazi rally in pre-war Germany. Students of Marshall McLuhan will tell you how radio created Nazism, the blitzkrieg, and mass obedience like nothing before it. As one psychoscientist put it, the stentorian voices of the mass media are more universally powerful than the indiscriminate persuasions of any mind-altering drug, right? And most of the survivors in this room probably don't watch a lot of television, right? Does anyone want to confess? Okay. But, never own one. Yes. Because it certainly is true. That's a powerful thing. Now, this is a guy that the Freedom of Thought Foundation, we're going to have an award. And all of you will have a chance to vote on who's going to get the first one. I've got it's very expensive to make those little statues, and I'm hoping nobody will pick it up so we can just peel off the brass plate, you know, every year and give and present the same one. And I don't know who. Well, we have a few candidates, like Jolyon West is a candidate, Martin Oren is a candidate, there's two or three others, but they'll all be on the ballot, and we're getting this organized. But I've been working on this brain, which is about this big, and it's gold, and it's fried black, and it's broken off, and it's got two electrodes in it, and it sits on a, like, it looks like kind of like a beer can, kind of scratched. It's all black and gold, you know, kind of a nice looking thing. And it's called the Mengele Award, after Joseph Mengele, this guy here. That's Joe. And he was one of the mind control men, you know, from the Ubermensch, you know. And there's nothing like opening your skull and letting your bare fingers run through someone's brain, I suppose, or freezing human beings to near the point of death and then finding them through trial, finding that through trial and error that the easiest way to defrost someone is to put them close to another naked human body. And these are just a few of the brutal experiments, though some of that was valuable for hypothermia and all that understanding. All of them, Joe Mengele did in Nazi concentration camps, and all of the records of his research are now on file at the National Archives. And we should probably get them all. I think some of them are still classified, too. But these are the people that he's working on. These are his subjects. And, of course, Mengele was fascinated by genetics. And I haven't really addressed genetics in here, but that's a whole area of research, and most survivors realize that it's multigenerational. Most sons and daughters of Masons realize that that's part of the Masonic belief, is that if you program or if you train or educate, or whatever the word is, a person for two or three generations, the knowledge begins to breed true. So, we're heading that way, and these twins were part of Mengele's studies, and they did a number of things. Twins appear to be telepathic. You know, there's an amazing thing. Of course, with NLP, you can understand how that works. In our workshops, we just demonstrate what looks like telepathy by mirroring and matching. If you can sit with somebody, match their breathing pattern, and establish an incredible rapport, you will experience, if they're sitting there in a state, imagining sitting on a mountaintop and the wind's blowing or whatever, you'll pick up the wind and you'll pick up all the sensory experience that they're having. You might not put it together the right way. You might say, I'm driving in my convertible and the wind's in my hair or something. But twins are known to be, because since they're, you can't match any better than twins, but they suffered great atrocities at the hand of Mengele, and they are here, and they have been interviewed, and that's the last picture that we know of that was taken with of Dr. Joseph Mengele, who was said to have been in Arizona in the 1960s, the persistent rumor is, but of course then they say he wasn't, he was down in Argentina, and he died down there, and but yet they're not sure that those are his bones, and so forth. And it is also a persistent rumor that he was one of the scientists that were brought over in Project Paperclip. We know he worked on a farm in Germany for a few years before the end of World War II. And there's the question of the green programming and the two proteges he had that were sent to Harvard and all that. And I'm sure you've heard this in the lore, but there's no proof of it. Of course, we won't, again, I keep harping on this, we won't find any documentation or proof until we repeal the National Security Act. Because as you begin to research in this thing, and I've been smashing my head against the National Security Act for 20 years, I mean, it's just impossible. They do whatever they want. Colonel Fletcher Prouty's a friend of mine. He said, they're over there now. He lives nearby. You can look out the window. He says, they're over there now. See the lights on? He says, they're Xeroxing forged documents to give to us. So you won't, and the National Archives is locked up as far as this stuff goes. Anything that's useful, anything that's about mind control, and we'll get back to that in a minute. There's so many doctors, I guess Colin Ross is writing a book about, he's following up on some of our research and that we did back in 25 years ago, and he's going into, he's found out, he's gotten the papers of Dr. Esther Brooks, and Esther Brooks knew Milton Erickson, who I think was a great guy himself, but he did work for the government, and they all knew each other, and Ewan Cameron comes in, And, you know, it's just it was a who's who of everybody that worked in the psychiatric mental health profession of that particular generation, my father's generation. Sociologist as well. And it's been going on for 50 years. Guys like Robert J. Lifton, even, who's, you know, thought of very highly, worked with Dr. John Mack, the alien guy, the UFO guy. They had a partnership that was in a little company that was funded by the CIA's MKUltra project, you know. And the National Institute of Mental Health, all the universities were used. You know the story, and if you don't, you can read Operation Mind Control. It gives you a big list of all this stuff, you know. I mean, it's just scratching the surface. And I hear some of you gasp about some of the stuff. You read Lifton's book, The Nazi Doctors. That's a pretty good, interesting study of how it takes up off of the obedience to authority kind of thing. How people can be made to do things that they wouldn't ordinarily do. Lest you gasp repeatedly throughout this presentation, let me generalize. Virtually every psychologist, psychiatrist, sociologist, cyberneticist, and so on, of that generation previous to mine, worked either wittingly or unwittingly for the CIA. The CIA, through a number of cutout organizations, co-opted the entire mental health profession and put it to work on mind control. So it's a hard thing finding people that aren't part of the game, you know, part of the bad guys. A few years after the end of World War II, about the time the CIA was being founded, and one of their first concerns, 1947, the Soviets engineered a show trial against Roman Catholic Cardinal Minzenti, who appeared before a kangaroo court in a trance and confessed to everything he was accused of, which a few years later he couldn't remember. The CIA looked into this and they said, you know, oh, they've got something that we don't have. We need this, you know. We better look into this. And so that's just in case you don't know. It was a fledgling agency in those days. We're celebrating its 50th anniversary, and I got a big kick out of George Bush standing up next to Richard Helms, who went to jail and was convicted of lying to Congress. He was the director of the CIA, and he's singing this man's praises, saying what a great patriot he was. Part of if you're a patriot, you lie to everybody. You lie to your country. You know, that's how far our morals and ethics have fallen. And so they wanted to duplicate. This is something off. This is talks about that. This is. Can you anybody read that? this is some of the things you find on the internet too. You find a lot of very good stuff, very succinct, and that talks about Harris Isabel in 55, part of MKUltra, Bluebird, and the hospital in Lexington, Kentucky, and things. And of course, Nelson Rockefeller wanted to become president one day. And he was standing at the bedside of Lady Liberty when she gave birth to her bastard child, a freak of nature, part of the invisible Cold War, known as information. They christened the baby Information Warfare, they called it. And then the father nicknamed it Brainwash, you know. So we have the Brainwash. It's a term. I noticed a previous speaker used that term. It's a very non-specific term. I mean, the term mind control isn't much better. But brainwash was coined by a CIA propaganda specialist, Ed Hunter. And he advised Alan Dulles, who gave a speech to the UN, and that's how brainwashing got started, the term, brainwashing. Of course, Dulles' brother was John Foster. He was the Secretary of State. And Allen called himself the Secretary of State for Unfriendly Governments. He was the director of the CIA. They talked about the insidious Fu Manchu communists in Korea and China who had brainwashed our clean-minded American boys and made them confess to crimes that they did not commit. According to Dulles, the Chinese had a way of making strong-minded Americans hallucinate that a U.S. Marine wing had flown a mission over North Korean-held territory dropping germ bombs. Colonel Charles Schwabel here took most of the heat. He was one of the men who allowed himself to be filmed confessing to the U.S. use of germ weapons. The cries of brainwashing could not drown out the later revelations that the Marine Air Wing had indeed dropped germ bombs on the insidious yellow people's fighting against the U.S. Later, it was revealed that the secret labs of Edgewood Arsenal had developed a race-specific encephalitis germ, which infected only Oriental people.